then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've your orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 5th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, what with all the sound and fury going on around here, I haven't responded to any emails recently. This is one I found lying around on my hard drive from a while back, and which I did answer at the time, but I think I'll give this lady a public response. Now, this is from Jessica in Arizona. Dear HAC, from what I've listened to on Radio Free Northwest, it seems financial concerns are a large part of people's choosing to put off coming home. In the case of people who do not own homes and have no wealth or savings, no credit, no one to borrow from, I can understand why you don't want these folks to just show up with nothing and expect to be taken care of. I also understand that you're trying to get more younger people involved in the cause, but one logistical problem is that they are more likely to have young children and plans to have more. And while this would not prevent homecoming, it may prevent those adults from being willing to do certain things when asked. Many people, myself included, do not want to end up dead or in prison before their kids grow up, and I think this very real expectation may cause some of the younger racialists to hesitate. In A Distant Thunder, when you write about one family's sacrifice for the Northwest Republic, one of your characters says, "God showed his divine mercy and stayed Abraham's hand. These aren't Bible times. God has demanded of me and my husband that we sacrifice our children, and he has not stayed his hand this time. While a noble decision, and in that case the only way, I would have to be honest about my own limitations and say up front that it's not something I'm willing to do. And I just remembered, in that story, both those daughters were grown. For situations that are not quite as life and death, younger people are still going to need to put much of their time and money to raising their children, while middle-aged people are less likely to have this issue. Just to use another example from my own life, tell you what, Jessica, I won't read that out on the air here. No point in giving any hostile listeners any more information than they need about your personal situation. And finally, one more unrelated question. What are your thoughts on the situation in Arizona? Something tells me I shouldn't care about a state not in our homeland and should just consider it gone, but I still feel like I should be helping out. Would you consider it disloyal in some way to the Northwest Republic if I got involved with some of the anti-immigration action here? Okay, first part of your question. I know that being a mother, you're really busy and you probably haven't had time yet to download and read and pore over every word I've written and spoken over the past 15 years, which is one reason I sometimes run reprints and reposts of my older stuff so new people can catch up and get a background on things like I've been doing on the Thought Crime blog this week. But I've often advised new migrants very strongly, do not just throw all your stuff into a U-Haul trailer and show up here on somebody's doorstep with $100 in your pocket and a t-shirt on your back and expect to be taken in and fed and clothed and housed. I have never advocated that. This is the crux of what I was talking about last week. Of course you save up your money first. Of course you come here on a scouting trip first so that we can get a look at you and you can get a look at the area where you will be living for the rest of your life. However, neither should you prospective migrants out there simply sit on your sofa and pay lip service to the idea of homecoming for months and years on end without ever lifting a finger to make it a reality. Now, when I say that you should be preparing to come home, I mean just that. I mean you really should be saving your money, not stopping off at the Quickie Mart for a 12-pack of beer every night on your way home from work. Another good way to save about $75 a month is to disconnect your cable TV. If you do without 1 year of cable, that will be 1 month's extra rent you've got in your pocket when you come home to the Northwest, or the deposit that will get you into an apartment or a renter house. That kind of thinking and that kind of behavior is what I mean. Now, when I say you should be looking for a job here in the homeland, I don't mean just some idle surfing the net at Monster.com or Craigslist every so often. I mean emails and resumes going out in the mail every day. I mean long-distance phone calls, tracking down human resources and personnel managers and getting them off their lunch break to talk to you. I mean hiring headhunting firms if you're on that level of employment. I mean multiple scouting trips if necessary to attend job interviews and locate rental housing prior to buying if you're on that economic level. Now, we were able to meet Stefan in person a couple of months ago when he came up here for just such an interview. Basically, guys, what I mean is that you people should actually be doing all this and not just tap, 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 tapping on a computer keyboard and yanking Harold's chain just enough so that you can stay on the list and continue to be entertained without actually having to put anything on the table. And yes, that happens. Now, if you have young children, that's great. The more the merrier. They're one of the reasons that you should be moving here in the first place, because it's infinitely to their benefit that they be raised here in the Northwest rather than Atlanta or Houston or Los Angeles or wherever the hell you are now. My novels are fiction, at least so far. That time is not now. It will come, but it is not yet. Now let's go over this again, and don't worry. I'll keep on repeating this to make sure it sinks in. There is no NVA, not yet, even though the FBI keeps going from door to door up here looking for it. There will not be one in any future which is as yet in any way foreseeable. I am not asking anyone to commit crimes and end up in prison. Far from it. One of our main duties right now as a community is to stay out of prison because there are so few of us, and we can't afford to squander a single racially conscious white life, which is the point that I was trying to make last week when I talked about the Craig Hicks incident in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. What I'm asking all of you to do is to take the first step on the road back to manhood, a step which is not only completely legal, but actually to your personal advantage in the long run. Now, the people I tend to get pissed off at, and the ones I'm referring to when I rant and rave here on Radio Free Northwest, are a certain class of largely movement people from way back in the 80s and 90s who have picked up some very bad habits in all their years of hanging around these other groups. They yanked my chain for years, promising me, next year, Hurl, next year for sure, for sure. I'll be right up there in the Northwest with you. I just got to save me a little bit more money. And, of course, there's the I got to get educated excuse. And it seems there's some college or technical course that the prospect absolutely must take because it will make him $1 million when he gets here. But, of course, we have no technical schools or colleges at all here in the Northwest. I'm always amazed to learn this fact. And the individual just has to stay where he is for a year or two so that he can take this course. The extra year or two stretches out to 3, then 4, you get the idea. Look, would it come as a surprise to you guys to learn that only a few weeks before I myself came home in May of 2002, when I was still down there in Texas, the land of air conditioning and armadillos, that I myself had a panic attack, kind of like that? I'd already resigned from my job, but I became obsessed with the idea that I wouldn't have enough money saved up even after I got my last paycheck, and I started rationalizing all kinds of good, solid reasons why I should withdraw my resignation and work through the summer, sock away some more dough, and come home in September or October. But I recognized this panic attack for what it was. I stuck to the plan. I came home in late May of 2002, and as it happens, I got a place to live after 3 days, and I was hired at the first job I applied to, although granted, I was a lot younger then, and this was in the relatively plush Bush first term when there was still a little bit of dot-com prosperity left over from the 90s. I also get pissed off at people who start by telling me up front that they have no intention of ever coming here, and yet they expect to take up my time and attention with the kind of fatuous, right-wing, quasi-intellectual crap that we have been wasting our time with for the past 50 years. They want to be my political mentors, or else the reverse. They want to sit at my feet and absorb my brilliant wisdom or whatever. They want to have long phone conversations with me and expect me to sit down and write them long, long letters, while all the time knowing that nothing concrete will ever come of it because they're quite happy where they're living, with their suburban lifestyle or whatever, and they have no intention at all of inconveniencing themselves for their race. I have actually had more than one person suggest to me down through the years that we imitate the original founders and form committees of correspondence for the sole purpose of writing each other long, long letters, which can someday be published after we're dead so everyone can know how brilliant we were and what great thoughts we mused upon as we sat by and watched our race and our civilization perish. These people want to continue the endless debate and the endless introspection and contemplation of our navels, which we have used as a substitute for action for the past 50 years. That endless debate is what has to stop. The debate is over. We know what we have to do now. And I have no more time for this deliberate and willful refusal to understand. Now, regarding the question of whether you should become active and involved in local racial politics where you are, that is entirely up to you. I make no secret of the fact that I believe everyone's primary focus should be on their Northwest homecoming, and that there should be no distractions from that, but I'm not some kind of cult guru or Chinese emperor issuing vermilion decrees telling everybody what they should do and what color socks they should put on in the morning. Now, I have come to accept, down through the years, that seemingly everybody has to go through my own learning curve on these things. Just don't lose sight of your migration plans and don't end up entangled with the law down there in some court case that's going to last for years. Now, I'm not worried about that any more than I'm worried about losing people to the libertarian migration in New Hampshire or the Christian fundamentalist migration in South Carolina. They've been going almost as long as we have, and both of them seem to have completely stalled. I know there are a lot of secession and migration movements going on elsewhere in the country besides here in the Northwest, like the Republic of Texas, for example, that got one of their meetings raided earlier this week and everybody ID'd and fingerprinted and their cell phones seized. Completely illegal, of course, but if no one's going to do anything about it when the regime breaks the law, they're just going to do whatever the hell they want because they've learned they can get away with it. The problem is that these secession movements are all attempting to use democracy, and the purpose of democracy is to prevent change. There will never be any serious secession movement coming from any state or local government, because the governor and the state authorities are part and parcel of the democratic system, small d, the system that feeds them and enriches them and gives them their status and their power. They've already shown that when the dictatorship cracks the whip, they will fold like a lawn chair. Weak and corrupt systems based on money produced weak and corrupt leaders who crumple when their wealth and their status is threatened. If you try to use democracy, you're going to get democratic politicians, small d, or in our case, big D. Periodically, especially out here in the West, there have been and there will continue to be these spasms of what appear at first glance to be resistance to the system. Sometimes there'll be events like that Cliven Bundy thing last year, and sometimes they'll come from state and local governments, Montana and Oklahoma, Texas state legislatures passing so-called state sovereignty motions, some sheriff in Montana or Wyoming announcing that he won't enforce any gun control legislation, the Oath Keepers thing, so forth and so on. Now, we need to make sure that we do not confuse these twitchings of the established democratic system with genuine revolutionary resistance. They are what might be called fruit of the poison tree. We Americans are hopelessly attached to the existing system and this whole establishment election nonsense because we've been taught all our lives that this is the best system of government in the world, despite the past century's accumulated mountain of evidence that it's just plain not true. Few of us are really interested in politics at all. What white Americans really want is just to be left alone to wallow in material luxury and fast food burgers and big screen TVs and in the mostly dysfunctional messes of our private lives. To most white Americans, the system is something to be avoided whenever possible, not changed. We have this deep psychological need to believe in the man on a white horse. We keep desperately searching for someone within the political system who will ride up on his white horse, flourish his saber aloft, and save us all without us ever having to take any risk or confront the United States government and its armed men. Remember, that 1-2 double whammy of cowardice and laziness which has destroyed our character and may yet destroy us all physically. Now, this is why we so idolize people like Jesse Helms or Ron Paul or Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck, because they provide a feel-good factor that salves our conscience to the point where we no longer notice that the bottom line of all these system saviors has been complete failure to reverse one single major liberal policy like diversity or abortion or illegal immigration or Obamacare. The last actual victory we ever won in this country was on November the 3rd, 1979, a very small one in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I can tell you from personal experience, we paid entirely too high a price for it. Now, this is the essence of the whole Tea Party movement. this frantic search for safety and salvation in a system which is designed from the ground up to prevent change. A system that can ignore a million people marching in the streets of Washington, D.C. because the Jews and the rich men in suits who actually have the power all arranged to be out of town that weekend. And because on Monday morning, the million people have all gone back home to their jobs and their computers and their TVs and their lives. That's democracy in action. And I'm sorry, Jessica, I'm babbling. I've lost the thread of your question. Let me see if I can drag myself back on track here. To cut to the chase, let me just say this. If any of these state sovereignty movements or whatever ever really do get off the ground, if Texas really does secede from the Union and resume the status of republic, as it's legally entitled to do, by the way, under the terms of its admission into the Union in 1845, if Arizona ever does decide to get serious and order a massive deportation of all illegals and tell Obama to go take a flying leap at a rolling donut, and if Montana or Wyoming ever do nullify federal law and proclaim themselves sovereign over their own people, then I will be the first to say, great, forget about the Northwest and off we go to wherever. But it won't happen. There will be a lot of posturing and a lot of speeches and court cases and talking heads on the cable news shows, but in the final analysis, it won't be real. Because the people who hold power on a state or local level are part and parcel of the same system, and they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. Now, how will we know if it's for real or not? Simple. When Obama tries to play Abraham Lincoln and orders the 82nd Airborne into Wyoming or Arizona to enforce some federal judge's order like Eisenhower did in Little Rock in 1958, I expect to see the governor standing on the state house steps with a rifle in his hand and not stepping aside for the federal marshals like George Wallace did. I expect to see state police and militia and National Guard firing on federal troops to defend their homes and their people, like happened in 1861. And like should have happened in 1958 in Little Rock. When we see dead feds lying on the streets in Laramie or Tucson, then it's for real. Anything else is a made-for-TV movie.
This is Arland Bran.
By the final months of the war, the aim of the approaching Allies was nothing less than the utter extinction of the German nation. Every woman, every child.
Enjoy the war, for the peace will be terrible. Judea's vicious retribution. We will never forget your suffering. Never forgive their deceit. Adolf Hitler, your name is revered. You tried to save your people through the power of your will. The glory of your nation shining like a sun. This vision of the future gives hope to everyone. Winston, Franklin and Joseph, Henry, Ilya and Dwight, you are the ones judged guilty of crimes against humanity. Women's Reich Labour Service, Neustettin, 1945. Unspeakable horror, they must be avenged. Adolf Hitler, your name is revered. You tried to save your people through the power of your will. The glory of your nation shining like the sun. This vision of the future gives hope to everyone. Adolf Hitler, your name is revered. You tried to save your people through the power of your will.
The glory of your nation shining like the sun. This vision of the future gives hope to everyone, to everyone.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is a book by Neil Postman. Now, this was something that was suggested to me, and it was written back in the 80s, so it's going to be somewhat dated. However, it's still relevant in terms of our relationship to media. This book asks, how does the media affect the message or even become the message? Now, what this author is talking about is the fact that prior to television, even back, from around the time that the printing press was invented to around the 1860s, what we had was a topographic culture, and that meant that ideas tended to be idea-based, whereas our culture today is more emotion-based. Now, granted, this author cites certain educational examples of television that were around during the 80s, and he talks about the example of Sesame Street, or also television programs that were designed for children and adolescents for the sake of classroom education. Now, even these attempts are strongly influenced by entertainment goals and visuals, and another problem is the limited attention span that tends to be caused by commercial interruptions. Now, granted, today it is possible with various recording devices to skip over commercials. And he does admit that television in other countries is somewhat different from the television that we know. Television in some other countries can take a more talking head format. And also, what he's saying may apply somewhat less to stations like C-SPAN and also examples like WGBH Boston, which tends to put out a lot of British television, which is also commercial-free due to donor contributions. But he is very much concerned with the influence of television on politics, because if a particular candidate is not very camera friendly or doesn't know how to utilize television to its best effect, then you have an individual who tends to be marginalized in terms of socio-political discourse. Now, he also speaks about this question of Orwell and Huxley, and while there were a great many people that were afraid of an Orwellian 1984 scenario, what we really have in our society is more of a Brave New World predicted by Huxley, because the mistake that Orwell made, as great of a writer as he was, is that he was really addressing the age of print. But really, the age of print started to die when we started to get, first of all, the telegraph, and secondly, photography. And those started working together, particularly when we started to have the development of syndicated newspaper columns, which could bring news from all over the world. Now, what we want to ask ourselves in the review of this book is, okay, what does this all mean for us as contemporary readers, and especially vis-a-vis this show for us as white nationalists? While I appreciate the intellectual discourse on the question of media, what a modern individual Any modern individual, even someone like myself, might see or might ask themselves, is this just a curmudgeon who naturally prefers print because he's an intellectual and he's nostalgic? Furthermore, other question, and the irony for those of us who would identify as National Socialists, unless we are very elderly, we likely had our first encounter with Hitler through television, which, of course, really rubs in a certain irony. Now, the other thing for the reader vis-a-vis this show is that television and film is often criticized within our movement because it's seen as a handmaiden of Jewish media. But of course, it need not only be so or always be so. I do recall a contributor to this show saying that the problem with television and I suppose also syndicated newspaper columns is that they take us away from the immediate and the here and now and make us less likely to get to know our neighbors. And the writer does say this as well. However, having a global view is not necessarily a hindrance to racial awareness. In fact, like so many of my generation, I became aware of some racial issues just by learning about the situation in South Africa. And I'm talking, of course, about the whole debate about apartheid and all the goings on there. At least some awareness of that was brought about by a combination of television and also syndicated newspaper stories that were going fairly global. So I was privy to a lot of things that I learned about that I would not have known of otherwise. Even so, and all of that being said, we do have a culture now that is image and emotion based, and we can certainly abstain from television, or we can watch or perhaps create, if we're actually in television, shows like Saturday Night Live, which the author seems to find redemptive in the sense that they ridicule television. However, I find shows like that to be, while amusing for a moment, to also be quite a time waster. So I can't really believe the author is very serious about this. Now, the takeaway from this book that I'm really getting out of it is it's not so much just a question of whether television is watched or not. What I'm really taking from this book, beyond just a question of television one way or the other, is a question of how arguments are framed and the language and vocabulary that is used to make arguments. And when I say language or vocabulary, I'm not just talking about the words in the dictionary. I'm not just talking about a language of, say, French versus German. What I'm talking about is really a question of how arguments are framed. For example, I was watching or listening to this radio show on the internet called Northern Runes Radio, and they were using a lot of vocabulary about awareness and awakening, and it was a very folkish and positive vocabulary. Now, a few minutes after that, I started watching another video, which was made by someone who was very unaware, and the thing that I really noticed, especially after having read this book, was that the person who was unaware was using a whole different vocabulary and frame of reference. So if I was to apply that to someone like Swedish Saga, for example, you could describe her as a white supremacist and an extremist, or you could describe her as someone who is fighting for culture and religion and the 14 words. You could describe her as heroic, or could describe her as perhaps someone very undesirable, and it all depends on how you're going to frame that argument. even though you could say very much the same thing, depending on the terms you use, you could create a totally different impression. So that's the takeaway from this book, an awareness of how arguments are framed, that I'm really going to say is the ultimate message of the book. Now, of course, we can certainly abstain from television. We can't uninvent it. So it's going to be, for good or ill, it's a part of our landscape. Times certainly do change. There's really nothing, again, for good or ill, there's nothing we can do about that. But what the author ultimately says, and what I think is the ultimate takeaway, is just an awareness of how any form of media, whether it's television or something else, influences our thought process. So even though this book is not directly tied to this movement per se, and while the author certainly is not sympathetic to us, I still thought it was a relevant subject matter, or at least relevant enough to put on this show. Now, from time to time, I have taken these requests, and sometimes I find them to be very useful. Other times, I find that the subject matter doesn't really apply directly to the show. But in any case, since we are a show about persuasion and discussion, and we are ourselves a form of media, I thought this was relevant enough to discuss. So thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Well, to back up Don's point, coming from, again, the other coast, and what's currently going on there, and all the snowfall, all the blizzards, I feel like I'm cheating coming out here.
It's been unseasonably warm in the Seattle area. For a couple weeks, it got into the 50s, and that was in January, which is unheard of even here, as mild as it is. I remember a little bit over a year ago, Don and I were concluding a party meeting with some others, and we stepped out. It was nice and clear, reasonable day in January, admittedly, in the Puget Sound, when we went into the meeting, and when we came out, it was snowing so hard we couldn't keep up trying to brush it off of our cars. We've had no snow this last winter. It's been incredibly mild and unbelievably pleasant.
And that year you were talking about, which I remember, that was the only time it snowed and actually laid on the ground, and for the first time in a long time, I got to actually drive in a little bit of snow.
Yeah, driving in snow around here is really rare in the Seattle area because it's generally not going to stick on the roads.
Yes,
really
I just want to emphasize that the Puget Sound area has a mild climate. Summer and winter, it's mild, and in both extremes, the extremes aren't very extreme, is what I'm saying. So if you're looking for a mild climate, this is a good place to be. And I would say in a world that appears to be running out of fresh water, this is also a nice place to be with all the water, all the rain.
I'd say over the time that I've been here, what I think is the most impressive thing is just being able to be yourself, not having to watch every word that comes out of your mouth. I'm in a store, I've got no problem even talking to the clerks.
Yeah, that's real easy. Actually, outside of Seattle itself, and I do mean literally Seattle itself, you can drive north a little bit and find all sorts of gun clubs and everything else. Even in Seattle, when I've had my firearm on my hip, I've had nothing but positive comments. And that goes in a city that's full of people that are supposedly, you know, hopped up on all sorts of idiot politics to the core.
Yes, in fact, that's another nice thing about the Northwest in general. It's very friendly to guns. Two states are the most friendly appear to, well, I mean, if you look at Montana, Idaho, and Washington, they're all very friendly states. And Oregon isn't too bad either.
The ability to, I mean, again, you kind of have to watch what you say on the streets in Seattle. Obviously, in workplaces, hold your tongue. But no, if you're not in an environment in part of this region where political correctness is being actively enforced, it sometimes feels like liberated territory. It really can in a lot of cases.
Yes, I agree. I would add that the gun thing, excuse me, at least in Washington State, is very easy to get a concealed pistol permit if you want one It only costs $54, and you get your fingerprints taken, and
a few weeks later, it shows up in the mail.
Well, a few days later, it shows up in the mail, and
in my case,
all you have to, and you don't have to take any gun safety courses. All you have to do is pass a background check to see if you've had any convictions, legal convictions, or I think they also check to see if you've been institutionalized against your will in a mental institution because someone's adjudicated you as being mentally dysfunctional or something like that. But the major issue is a background check to see if you've ever been convicted of anything criminally. If you have a clean record, then it's automatic and it's quick and easy.
Now, I remember you mentioning a story about a woman you were talking to on the ferry, Don. About a joke she just openly came up and told you about.
Oh, yeah. Last time you came over here, you were telling
yes.
me about this. Yeah,
yes,
go ahead.
Yes,
repeat that story. It's really interesting.
I'm trying to remember what the joke was that she told me. Maybe you remember what it was? Because I told you.
She approached you
yes.
out of the blue and said, would you be offended by racist humor? And, of course, we're not going to be.
No.
I don't remember the joke she told, but apparently there was an exchange that went on back and forth for a while.
Yeah, we started exchanging jokes back and forth. I think I told her my favorite Jew joke, which is, how do you say, fuck you in Yiddish? And the answer, of course, is, trust me. Anyway, this was out of the blue, and as Andy said, she approached us, and that was a bit of a surprise. And I will say that I've talked to other people here. I went into a big box store, and I talked to a middle-aged woman was helping me, and we were chatting. I think I let her know that I'd moved up from California just like a year or so ago, and she said, oh, she also lived in California in San Diego, and she moved up something like 15 years ago or something. I made the remark that I sure like this place better than California, you know, better than multiracial, multicultural California, and she paused for a second and said, yes, I agree.
It's amazing when people don't think they're monitored, the things they'll say along those lines.
Yes.
So another question that's just occurred to me, since I've got people here, I talk about this all the time, but I thought I'd ask what you guys, what are your, if you want to call it this, what are your favorite naysays against the Butler Plan? All of the idiocy that's directed against us, if I weren't laughing at it, I'd be crying because it's so utterly pathetic that white people won't do this or will actually oppose it. And
well, I'll tell you that clearly the biggest problem with the Butler Plan is getting people to move. The rest of it isn't too difficult. If you get people to move up here, then the rest follows almost naturally. But the hard part is getting people to move up here. Now, that's not a naysay. I think I understand what you're saying.
Right.
The reasons people give for either not moving or for opposing the whole idea is what you mean by a naysay.
Right.
And from that, I think typical naysays, of course, are, oh, you put everybody, you know, in one place and it's easy for them to suppress us, which, of course, is they've got it backward. Perhaps the fundamental principle of military tactics and strategy is to concentrate your forces in a location to give you an overwhelming advantage in that location where your enemy is spread out.
And
well,
and you're,
of course,
you're not,
in our case...
You're not just making that up. You are actually in the military.
I'm a veteran, but the point is that doesn't make sense. The other naysays, I see AJ here is like itching to cut in here, but I want to say that another one is that they posit other locations, but the other locations are either landlocked or too small. And I agree with Harold when he says, you know, we need a coastline, we need ports to have commerce with the rest of the world, which I think is a good thing. And, of course, the other thing is we need a large chunk of territory for all the people we're going to put in it. And the Northwest has plenty of empty land that people can settle in. The naysays that I see being promoted, those are the ones that I think are the ones you hear about most.
Sure. AJ?
Well, I think the biggest positive point is it's doing what they don't want you to do because they want to stick all these mudbloods into your communities, into white communities. To come here where there is a white community, occupy the space to keep the muds out.
And eventually for good, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the overwhelming thing that baffles me about the rest of the white nationalist movement is, at best, their suggestions are, pretend this isn't happening. No, I don't understand what it is they think they're going to do with, you know, whether it's Southern secession or other types of secession or, you know, let the economy fall apart or whatever. What are you actually going to do about the demographics problem? There's no thought given to what actually causes white genocide, and there's especially no thought given to how to prevent that underlying cause. And I would love to hear from any of the naysayers if they'd like to argue with me on that. Okay, what are you going to do about it?
Some of them do promote other ideas, but again, I think those other ideas fall far short of the Northwest Imperative idea.
Certainly fall far, far short of it.
I think we ought to say something about the Northwest novels, because those are a big deal. They're a major part of our propaganda. I enjoy them tremendously.
Harold, you just reread The Brigade, didn't
I? Just reread The Brigade while I was recovering from being sick, or while I was sick, and you pick up things that you don't the first time around, and of course then there are things that you forgot, and things you don't even remember seeing before when you read through. It's a long novel, so there's a lot there. And good stuff, because the novels, in addition to being very inspirational, which they are, and they're fun to read, which they are, they're also instructional. You learn things from them, useful things, and it's all around a good thing to do. I can't recommend them enough.
I always jump in whenever we start talking about the Northwest novels and point out that while it's difficult to do, I read them the first time on a computer screen in PDF format.
So did I, by the way.
it's not easy to do, but it's well worthwhile. I was so intrigued, I said this recently on RFN as well, but it's worth repeating, I was so intrigued that I couldn't wait for physical copies of one of the books, so I got my hands on the PDFs and devoured them. The novels, for those of you who haven't read them, they are the metaphoric finished picture on the front of the puzzle box. They show you what the end goal of the party needs to be. The reason for writing them in a fictional scenario where the Northwest Volunteer Army is actively resisting the federal government with the purpose of detaching the Northwest American Republic from the United States, Harold uses the phrase Aesopian language, and that's certainly what he's doing there, where we're discussing events and ideas that need to be thought of, even if only in a fictional way right now. And
also, Harold likes to say, which I think is very important, the purpose of the novels, as he says, is not to tell you what to do, it's to show you what to be.
Yes, yeah. The party as a whole needs to be a group of dedicated white nationalists who are capable of managing the process of actively opposing the federal government.
Yes, and there are many ways to do that, and not all of them involve violence or illegality, and that's an important point to emphasize here. The Northwest Front, I will flat out say here, is completely legal, and everything it does is legal, and everything it advocates is legal. Let's not get carried away with the fantasy here. And the Aesopian language thing can also be misconstrued, so let's be careful not to misconstrue that.
Right.
The whole point of the novels is to inspire you, to show you the end goal, to show you, basically based on history, how people have gotten to that end goal in similar circumstances, and to show people basically that white people can achieve this if we want to. And another interesting thing, although it requires a population that's not hostile to us, it doesn't require a large number of people to pull it off either.
No, it certainly doesn't.
And Andrew Jackson had a famous quote. He says, "One man with courage makes a majority." That's something to consider here as well.
Definitely. My personal favorite thing about the Northwest novels is that they were the catalyst for what caused me to start thinking along the lines of seriously evaluating the Butler Plan and or the Northwest Imperative for its feasibility, because they show you in a fictional context what would need to happen to make that a reality. That's what caused me, again, I said this recently on RFN, but it all bears repeating, this is what caused me to start investigating the seriousness of certain methods of bringing about change. And believe it or not, Harold Covington isn't making any of this up. Time and time again in history, these methods have been used to liberate people who wanted to be free badly enough. And they would work if we made use of them.
Absolutely, I agree.
This is from the soundtrack of one of the truly great British historical series on TV called Sharp's Rifles. It's about the Napoleonic Wars. It stars Sean Bean. And if ever you guys get a chance to check out this series, I think it's about 13, 14 episodes now, you need to grab it because this is a real swashbuckler. Anyway, this selection's called The Spanish Bride.
Sailed out of England, bound for Lisbon Harbor, bayonets gleaming and pride to fall.
home that we tried hard to cherish. Thoughts of our loved ones on England's fair shore. Soon we're transported to hell and its fury. Through smoke and through fire, through shot and through flame. That Talavera we stole born is eagle. In that short time we were heroes of Spain. Her eyes, they did glister like two diamonds bright. We spoke not a word at our very first meeting. Later on, all that long Spanish night. Travel together o'er mountain and valley. She by my side through many's the fight. She tended my suffering, she solved me pity. Bore me a daughter, my heart's delight. Marched into Lisbon, proud Wellington's army. The war being over, it's homeward we're bound. All on the quayside, the weeping and the wailing. 4,000 women left on that cold ground. Farewell and adieu to you, Spanish lady. Farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain. We've received orders to sail on to England. But I know in some time we'll return once again. Once again. Once again. If ever I'm returning, it's with gold and great plenty. If I return, it's with gold and great store. Search far and wide for my Spanish lady, brought me such peace amidst of such war. Farewell and adieu. Spanish lady, farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain. We've received orders to sail on to England. I know in some time we'll return once again. Farewell and adieu to you, Spanish.
Spanish lady. Farewell and adieu to you ladies of Spain. We've received orders to sail on to England, but I know in some time we'll return once again.
Right, looks like I'm already running long here at 51 minutes. I did speak with Rodney, and he tells me it's okay for his ANN network for our segment to go a few minutes over an hour, but sometimes RFN can go like an hour and 12 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes, and that would be abusing Rodney's hospitality. Realistically, this means that I will have to leave Stefan and Annie and also the trucker again until next week. Because I got a fairly serious sounding complaint this week, yet again, that I am not speaking enough on these shows, and people don't tune in here to hear all these other characters. They want their weekly Herald ration, yada, yada, yada. So it looks like they'll get their wish this week, because that's what I'm going to talk about. Now, I don't think I have gone over this HAC fixation that some of you seem to have yet, where the new listeners at the All Nationalist Network can hear me, and I need to do that. First off, I may be wrong, but this commenter on the blog was anonymous, and he might have been a troll. We do have this one troll that hangs around on the Homeland blog all the time, pretending to be some kind of white nationalist or movement guy. He posts under different aliases and IP addresses, but he doesn't seem to realize that his script, his template, has become clearly recognizable through long familiarity, and when he shows up, he might as well have a sign around his neck saying, Cass Sunstein is signing my checks. Now, like I said, this one comment might have been him. The writing style is close, but since this is an actual issue, I'll treat it like it was a legitimate comment and reply to it, and so if it is this troll, you can go to your supervisor's cubicle and see if you can get a cash bonus or a little gold star on your FAR this week for getting me to respond. Okay, let's run this down for everybody again. This is not the Harold Covington show. The Northwest Front is not a one-man band. It is a racial idea with multiple advocates. The purpose of these podcasts and the Northwest Observer is not to sell my books, nor is it to advertise the Harold Covington brand, as they say these days in yuppie talk. Oh, wait, there are no more yuppies, are there? These days it's hipsters. Sorry. Anyway, I am not a fearless leader or a cult guru living in a remote rural ashram where I sit around thinking great thoughts and diddling a series of Eastern European mail order brides. Now, a large part of our problem down through the years has quite frankly been my own extreme reluctance to become a movement fearless leader again. I did that in the 70s and the 80s, and it was not an edifying experience. I really, really don't fancy, once again, running a junior high school full of middle-aged adolescents. I just don't want to have to deal with all the bullshit, although it looks, frankly, like there's going to be no escape. It is vitally important that other people become involved in this Northwest Independent Movement besides me, and that other people are known to be involved and step forward and make their voices heard. I cannot be responsible for running the entire kit and caboodle for specific reasons I've gotten into in the past, both publicly and privately, which I won't go over again, but basically because there is simply too much chance that I will not be around too much longer for either medical or legal reasons, and when I do disappear from the scene, I want to make sure my life's work doesn't disappear with me. Of course, neither do I want to get into all kinds of democracy and corporate bureaucracy and form without function like Pierce did and leave a National Alliance-style mess behind me, which is a story I won't get into. It is a crucial part of the way I'm having to roll with all this that the voices of other people be heard and that I get at least a few of you to step forward, at least to the point where you will speak out loud for the Northwest Republic. I admit that there is also a good deal of self-interest going on here. It is dangerous to me for the secret police to get the idea that this NF thing is just a one-man band and they can make it go away by taking me out. Now, all of that being said, when things settle down here a bit, and I anticipate that happening over the next month or so, I will try to put together a few more of what I used to call shortcasts. 8 or 10 minute brief commentaries on specific subjects and upload them to the northwestfront.org website on Saturday or Sunday. Also, we're still looking into the possibility of doing a call-in show. One of the things I'd like to ask you guys is what time and what day of the week would be good for this? For most of you, I know we got people scattered all over the country, all 4 time zones. We got people scattered all over the world. That's going to be a problem, is selecting the best time for us to do, say, a 2-hour call-in where enough of you will be available to call in. Okay. Now, to make a long and complex story as short as possible, I've kind of hoisted the white flag on any hope of my not ending up in my so-called golden years as the principal of Movement Junior High, because after almost 13 years of my trying to pretend otherwise and hoping that white people will change and grow up and that things will just work out, it appears that until Movement Junior High does get a principal, there will be nothing but a bunch of middle-aged and elderly white-haired teenagers running around in the halls screaming and shouting dirty words and slamming lockers and throwing paper airplanes and trash cans at one another. And I will now leave that rather strained analogy alone. Suffice it to say that there are some changes coming within the Northwest Front itself to make us more viable as an actual political movement, and no, I will not discuss these in public. Believe it or not, I do have at least a little bit of discretion. Okay, time for one more music break. This is Sean Davey and Rita Connolly from the Granuala album, which is kind of a musical retelling of the story of Grace O'Malley, the pirate queen of Western Ireland in the 16th century, one of the few genuine warrior princesses in history. Anyway, for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.